Morell showed up. It took chutzpah. You told Charlie what you thought, then he took it, and then he would draw it up on the plate. We just had so many rotating specials. Charlie would have specials written up for the entire week, so you knew every minute of every day what you were doing. Nothing came from left field. It was all well thought out. We ran like a machine. It was the best learning experience anyone could have. I went back to school after my internship, and before I graduated, I was like, I can't wait to get back to New York. I'm wasting my time at school. The unbridled energy and adventurousness of the Palmer years at the River Cafe are summed up by many who were there by a smoker the crew built. We built a smokehouse in the building, says Palmer. We got this huge, basically walk-in cooler and piped in the smoke source. And this is all out of a book, you know? A DIY project, totally. But it was great because we're going to smoke all our own salmon. We're going to smoke sausages. We're going to do all that stuff. We created a curing room. You didn't even think about it. You just said, okay, there's some space over there. I remember we sent Neil Murphy out to this place out in Brooklyn, and he brought back this walk-in cooler for nothing. It was out of a junkyard. I don't even know how he found it. We knew we had to have a big, big container. The locker room was 30 or 40 feet from the side of the restaurant, says Murphy. We got an old double-door fridge, took the guts out, popped a hole in the side, put an aluminum manifold in it. We wanted to cold smoke. We smoked everything. Salmon, squab, quail, shrimp. One time we must have left 20 sides of salmon in there, and we overcooked them, hot smoked them. We had 20 sides, so we made consomme, raviolis, rillettes. We never let any of that go to waste. Charlie, you know, you want to try something? We'd try it, says Burke. And you had the manpower to do it. And you could sell anything at the River Cafe. I made smoked kidneys. I made kidneys taste like bacon, served it with calf's liver. Instead of bacon and onions, I'd do leeks and kidneys. We could sell anything because we had forward-looking customers, but also a lot of tourists. We had a lot of Japanese people that came in. You wouldn't make something in vain. It would sell. All of this was undertaken in addition to the daily demands of the kitchen, and the crew wore the workload as a badge of honor. We were inundated with prep, says Hayden. It was unbelievable, the amount of work it took that we had to get ready for service every single day. We were better than other kitchens because when I heard about all the people that would do the vegetable blanching, that was all our responsibility. There was no guy that blanched the vegetables. Every cook was responsible for getting his veg, sauce, and proteins together. That's why I had a big head. The long hours and like-mindedness produced a pack mentality. We were like a gang, says Murphy. I loved that. You never had to worry that somebody was going to take you down because other guys were going to watch out for you. That was the vibe. If one guy couldn't get set up on time, somebody's going to help you. If the grill guy gets 50 orders and the sauté guy gets 10, he had your back. You didn't even have to ask. We all loved each other. Love is a strong word. To where you'll fucking almost die for that guy for whatever reason, that's how we felt about each other. It was a pretty amazing feeling. You rarely get something like that. Hayden remembers the restaurant as fiercely supportive and friendly competitive. There were times where we could race each other from the minute we got on the door to see who could be set up with their station, all their mise en place, everything they needed to do for that day. Because I worked the fish station, and the fish station at the River Cafe was two people. Then there was a sauté guy and a grill guy. And so me and Neil Murphy, we would bet that we could set up faster and better and be outside a half hour before service started. The long days, punctuated by peaks and valleys, created an extraordinary need to blow off steam. Between prep and service, Murphy and Hayden would knock back multiple double espressos, meet out back on the barge, and while the other cooks sucked down cigarettes, get each other pumped up for a service, wrestling and pinning each other down and screaming, "Are you ready?" in each other's face. It was extreme, even by River Cafe standards. "I think the rest of the folks thought we were crazy," says Hayden. After hours, as with most kitchens, then and now, alcohol was a must. Most of the time, says Murphy, the crew would hit a bar. "We would go out every single night and suck down a bunch of beers," he says. "Occasionally, we would sit out on the deck at the River Cafe, and we would drink all night for free, sometimes till 4 in the morning. I never wanted to leave." Murphy recalls the bridge as a presence. This big, looming, ugly, beautiful, historic piece of art. He also recalls that when there were jumpers, they would close the bridge, and we would be slow for several hours. Once or twice a month, says Murphy, Burke might arrange for the team to meet with another restaurant's crew across the river in Manhattan, and we would drink and do blow all night. The drinking actually began at the start of service. There were two cases of beer put on the line, on ice, at the beginning of the night, remembers Murphy, who found himself half-hammered by the end of the night, which impaired his cleanup. You're just dumping everything into the garbage. That's one thing that brought us all together, says Murphy. If you didn't come out and drink with us, you were on the outside. They were magical times at the River Cafe, but as for Forgione before him, Palmer's days were numbered from the get-go, because, mostly due to the examples of the French Nouvelle Cuisine titans, he had realized, hey, we're the engine in this business. We should own it or be a partner in it. He told O'Keefe that he needed to become a partner or push off. O'Keefe, not one to make decisions quickly, considered it, and considered it, and considered it, until Palmer realized it simply wasn't in his DNA. Over lunch at Le Grenouille, Palmer told him about an offer he had to become a partner in another restaurant. I said I thought it was too good to pass up, says O'Keefe, letting another future all-star slip away. We were doing the flavored oils first. David Burke's path to the River Cafe was longer and more convoluted than his predecessors. Known as a wild man to this day, his reputation has obscured his chops, which were among the most impressive of any of his contemporaries. Burke grew up in Hazlitt, New Jersey, a better-than-average student for a cook, blessed with the ability to retain information and mentally organize it. In time, he'd graduate early from high school. He was also industrious, with a bruising paper route, and competitive, especially in wrestling, which could bring out the beast in him. Like many tri-state area kids, his first interest in cooking came not from food, but from the kitchen environment, discovered in a dishwashing job in a local hotel at age 14. There he was mesmerized by the chefs and cooks, their butchery skills, and the camaraderie of the kitchen. In 1980, when he was 18, came the Culinary Institute of America, and a weekend gig private chefing for a hotel owner at his Catskills home. Burke simply couldn't stop screwing around with food. In the private chef gig, he made snails bouguigone, but wrapped the snails in chicken tenderloin. He externed at the Fairmont Hotel in Dallas, Texas, taking a night job in another restaurant to pay the rent. Then it was back to New Jersey and the fromagerie in Rumson. Though just the broiler man, Burke was beginning to experiment in earnest, and the owners, Hubert and Marcus Peters, were open-minded, put his dishes on the menu. The first was a riff on poulard de midoye, with a stuffing of ricotta and spinach between skin and meat, creating a three-layer effect when roasted. In his second year at the CIA, he dabbled in cooking competitions. After graduating, named most likely to succeed, he cooked for a family in Norway. In the interview, his prospective employer asked him if he could make certain dishes. He rattled off the recipes and approaches he'd take to create them from memory. He got the job, traveled around Europe, too poor to eat in the best restaurants, but made a study of the menu boxes out front. Back in the States, he took a saucier position under Waldy Malouf at Le Cremier. He was swiftly promoted to sous chef, stayed on for 2.5 years, then took a job, with the assistance of André Daguillon, at Le Rapier in Mauvaison, France. He dined at Michelin three-star restaurants, catching the attention of the chefs with his enthusiasm and appetite, ordering dishes beyond those featured on the degustation menus. Bocuse joined him for a glass of wine. Pierre Toigrot gave him a kitchen tour. Back in New York City, he took a job as fish cook with a young, newly arrived chef named Daniel Boulon at the Hotel Plaza Athénée. Bored with the style of the food there, he jumped when mentor Malouf recommended him to Palmer at the River Cafe, where Palmer's laboratory style absorbed Burke's burgeoning creativity. And on the menu went such dishes as shrimp and ginger wontons and oysters with watercress on roasted peppercorns. After a year, he took 6 weeks to return to France, work for Georges Blanc, Toigrot, and Marc Menon. One day, when eating a slice of pizza, Burke noticed the red oil that oozed onto the plate. Oil from the cheese and tomato. It was red. It looked pretty on a plate. I'm like, I can flavor oils, man. Then we started making them colorful. Curry, tomato. Now I've got a lighter sauce. The flavored oils were deployed for economy and elegance. I had tuna tartare on the menu, and I had horseradish with ginger in it, and I didn't want the pieces. I wanted it to be smooth. So I took the peels and made oil. I didn't throw shit away. I was using the peels and made oils. Now we pour that oil in the tartare, you get the flavor. To this day, Burke maintains that he was employing flavored oils before Jean-Georges Van Gerichten, who came to New York City in 1985 and took over the kitchen at Lafayette, became famous for them, among many other flourishes and innovations. Now I've got a pretty plate. I got color. Listen, I worked at River Cafe. I had to get people's eyes on the plate, not out the window. In December 1987, he discovered that Palmer was on his way out. Burke was supposed to leave with Palmer, become his lieutenant in his new venture, but O'Keefe offered him the chef's position. "Buzzy, I can't take this job. I'm not qualified," said Burke. "You're qualified," said O'Keefe. "Everyone in the building says you are." Burke felt that before he could assume command of the barge, he needed to know more about pastry. He reached out to Michelle Richard at Citrus in Beverly Hills, offered to work for free, but Richard refused him. Burke told O'Keefe he wanted to go to Gaston Lenote in Paris, and O'Keefe backed him. "I came back to the river as the chef. I brought a pastry chef back with me, and then we just started rocking and rolling," says Burke. "We put 24 desserts on the menu. I knew how to cook classic food. I knew a little bit about what modern American ingredients were. And then I just said, listen, I'm going to do it my way. I'm going to take chances. I'm going to twist it. And I'm going to craftsmanship the hell out of some of this stuff, too. And listen, I made the chocolate Brooklyn Bridge." The bridge was one of the great pieces of cleverness in restaurants at that time, a miniature chocolate replica of the restaurant's neighboring landmark. They sell $25,000 worth of Brooklyn Bridges a year, maybe more, and Buzzy will never take it off the menu. They make it smaller, but because I had some pastry knowledge then, I said, listen, that's what I want. I want to sell it for two. I want it to be the iconic dessert of this place. I'm not a pastry chef, per se, but I like to be in that. I like theater desserts. I like people to take the Instagram or mental shot before Instagram and take it home, you know? Because it ends your meal with a smile. I think I was one of the guys that was more concerned with entertaining the public with presentation and great combinations and ahas, says Burke. Burke was so proud of his food, he once asked O'Keefe to drape the windows so diners could focus on it. "He thought I was fucking nuts," says Burke, who recalls O'Keefe simply walking away, shaking his head, unwilling to even dignify the request with a verbal response. Though Burke does recall a moral victory the night Chicago chef Jean Blanchet and Le Cote Basque's Jean-Jacques Rachou came to dinner and turned their chairs away from the windows, telling O'Keefe, "We came to look at the food." Burke ran a demanding ship at the River Cafe. Paul Zwevin, a young cook from New Jersey who had been working in restaurants and bakeries for almost 10 years, graduated the Culinary Institute of America, interviewed with Burke, told him he had been an executive sous chef in his last position at the Pavilion Hotel in Miami Beach, Florida. Burke, himself just 24 at the time, was unmoved by his status and offered him a cook's position at $8.75 an hour. Zwebin was all too happy to take the demotion. On his way into the office, at the tail end of lunch service, he'd been mesmerized by the kitchen, which he described as magical. "I saw all these cooks moving around like it was a ballet." He also sensed the machismo that had been a defining characteristic of the Palmer era. There was a tremendous amount of testosterone in the room. You could just feel it. You could feel that this was a competitive kitchen, and if you were going to survive in it, you had to do whatever it took to survive. We all worked 6 shifts a week, so you basically worked 4 days or 4 nights, and then you did a double. So you could work literally from, you know, 2 in the afternoon to 1 or 2 in the morning. Then you would be back the following morning at 7, and you would work literally 18 hours, and then you would be off for a day or two. And that's how it was, says Zwevin. The drinking culture also continued. The only moment that presented itself for Zwevin to talk to Burke about becoming a sous chef was after hours. We were at a bar, and it was 4 in the morning, and everyone had left, and I was like, this is the time for me to talk to him about becoming a sous chef. And we went to a bar that was closed that actually opened for us at 4 a.m. So the gates go up, and the bartender's like, hey, David. And I'm completely wasted out of my mind. And I think we drank until, like, 7 in the morning. And he drank gin and tonics. And I think I actually tried one that night and almost vomited. But it's just how we did it. So, you know, we would work. Basically, we would get into work if we worked the night shift anywhere between 12 and 1 or 2. You would be completely wired at midnight. By midnight, we would start drinking. As we were shutting down, we would have a couple beers in the kitchen, and then it was time to go out. And we would go out and drink hard pretty much every night. Diane Forley, one of the few women to work at the River Cafe in the 1980s, recalls the kitchen. That was like walking into the Culinary Institute of America. Everybody had their toolbox. It was very intense, she says. Not many people came in off the street the way I did. It was very hard. Forley began as a prep cook, but lobbied for the position of tourneur, roundsman, who fills in on every station as needed. David finally put me there, and that, for a woman, was a big deal. There weren't any women line cooks. It was just guys, even garde-manger. So I became one of the guys. I was there for so long, they ignored that. Forley abstained from the after-hours binge drinking, but even at the restaurant, during working hours, she remembers the River Cafe as more of a wild kitchen. It had an army-like military feel to it. I think they liked the regimented part of it because it kept them in order. People liked feeling like they belonged to that. We all sort of paid our bills, says Webben, but no one worked there to get rich. We worked there because this was a place to work where eventually we were going to be like, you know what, Daddy? It's time for us to be a chef. We're out of here. And then he would let us go. A fringe benefit of being a sous at the River Cafe, O'Keefe gave sous chefs a $50 per week dining allowance to try other restaurants around town. I make big-name chefs. I don't hire them. There was a common trait among the chefs. O'Keefe says it was that they all had to have some kind of an ego to pursue excellence. You have to want to pursue that somehow. It's a make-or-break trait for him. He once told a sous chef who wanted to fill in for a chef on leave that he was a good enough technician, but that he lacked the pursuit of excellence. You have to be crazed to make it perfect. He knows of whence he speaks. To this day, O'Keefe remains a stickler for detail. He can tell you the perfect way to serve Perrier, well chilled, in a chilled glass, rather than with ice, which threatens the minuscule carbonation bubbles when it melts. From day one at the restaurant, he kept dairy, meats, and fish in separate coolers, so they wouldn't absorb each other's odors. Cream is like a sponge, he says. His idiosyncratic perfectionism and taste extended to his choice of chefs. Forgione, says O'Keefe, wanted a named chef to replace him when he left, but O'Keefe had other plans. I make big-named chefs. I don't hire them, he said. I was the only one of my staff who wanted to take Charles Palmer. He was a big country boy. I said, no, this is the guy it's going to be because I think he has the pursuit, the energy, and he's pursued me. Eventually, Burke, like the others, left the River Cafe for the Park Avenue Cafe in Manhattan. I don't like to see them go, says O'Keefe. But go they do. It's been an inevitability, a fact of life at the River Cafe. 4. French Resistance. I don't think it bothered us that we thought they didn't respect us. I don't know if we respected them. Tom Carlin. How the French Guard and a generation of young American cooks learned to live together in New York City, and the Culinary Underground Railroad that helped bridge the gap. David Kinch, chef owner of Manresa, a Michelin three-star restaurant, plies his trade in the affluent placidity of Los Gatos, California, an hour south of San Francisco. Kinch exudes West Coast tranquility. He even surfs on his days off, but he has been in one fistfight in his life. The year was 1984, and the Pennsylvania native, then in his early 20s, was working a stage at Hôtel de la Poste in Beaune, France, an ancient walled town in the heart of Burgundy country. Late one night, after most of the brigade had cleared out, Kinch found himself alone with the pastry chef, brother of the restaurant's sous chef. Kinch considered the brothers the definition of douches, who laid rubber on their way to and from work in a Citroën sports car, a flaming eagle emblazoned on its hood. As was the case in many kitchens of the day, the French masters rode the Americans in their kitchens harder than the rest of the crew, seasoning the punishing workload with a pinch of prejudicial ridicule. Kinch usually brushed it off, but that night was different. "He pushed me too far," remembers Kinch. "He was deriding me. American, American. He was saying some really derogatory things. I just snapped and pushed him against the wall." With action movie convenience, a pile of egg flats was stacked within Kinch's reach. He began chucking the orbs at his tormentor. "He went down," says Kinch. "I was hitting him hard. I was throwing them like baseballs. He was cowering in the corner, and I emptied the whole fucking tray on him, just one after the other, maybe 60 eggs as hard as I could from 15 feet away." Kinch fully expected to be fired, but when he returned the next morning to face the music, the place was spotless, and his nemesis, humbled, greeted him as if nothing had happened. He had proven himself worthy of fear and respect, and his reward for taking that leap was peace and survival. The showdown illustrates the love-hate dynamic between a subset of young American cooks desperate for knowledge in the 1970s and 80s, and the French chefs who possessed, and in many cases, hoarded it. This complex relationship acts as an overlay to the story of the Five Couples, and to the River Café, and other boundary-breaking restaurants of the time, and also defined the formative years of many cooks who came up seeking little more than a mastery of French cooking technique. You had to learn from them. They had the keys. The United States and France had long enjoyed a warm relationship, but the professional kitchen was French territory, and when Americans began infiltrating that sacred ground, it often led to friction. The French, generally speaking, considered the Americans talentless, with palates honed at McDonald's. The Americans considered the French haughty, exclusive, and oftentimes abusive. Neither camp was entirely right or wrong. This culture clash was mostly an East Coast phenomenon, reflecting the Atlantic seaboard's inherent conservatism, predilection for French food, and relative proximity to Europe. The Five Couples and other Ottos were the exceptions. Generally speaking, young Americans in the tri-state area sought to emulate the French and also coveted their approval. It made sense. France continued to dominate and define what for most was the epitome of Western cuisine. Tourists hadn't yet discovered or developed a respect for the pleasures of Italy's regions in droves as they would in the coming decades. Those who ruled the roost in France, especially Nouvelle Cuisine honchos like Paul Bocuse, Michel Gérard, and Alain Chapelle, still towered like deities over the gastronomic universe. And the touchstones that united American home cooks pointed toward France and its cuisine as well. Julia Child, Richard Olney, and Elizabeth David were all culinary Francophiles. French restaurants were the only venue for fine dining in America's major cities. And, of course, the language of the kitchen itself, sauté, flambé, julienne, was French. One book resonated more than most of these young cooks, Great Chefs of France, by food critic Quentin Crewe and photographer Anthony Blake. A collection of portraits, profiles, kitchen layouts, menus, and recipes, it depicted the culinary chieftains of every three-star restaurant outside Paris at the time of its publication in 1978. The fascination with the tome devoted to the professional kitchen highlighted a key difference between this subset of cooks and many of those who took up professional cooking in Northern California, and the Five Couples, who were devoted to the likes of Child, David, and Olney. French culinary supremacy was such a given that Great Chefs of France author Crewe could include the following sentence without irony. "The relative indifference shown to its chefs in the past only compounds the mystery of why France is the only Western country to have made cooking into an art and raised its appreciation to the level of connoisseurship." Terence Brennan, who grew up in Annandale, Virginia, and would go on to open his own Picheline restaurant and artisanal bistro in New York City, remembers receiving the book as a gift from a friend's mother after he catered a party for her. That was the turning point. When I opened that book, my mouth dropped. I saw those Michelin-starred kitchens, all the copper and silver, and the chef's tie underneath the suit. Louis Outier and Bocuse, and seeing them squeeze sauce through cheesecloth. I was like, I've got to go to Europe. I was always fascinated by that book and what they were doing. I would just stare at it and read it. I had the menus memorized, says Kinch, who was born in Pennsylvania and started cooking as a teenager in New Orleans, where he worked for Paul Prudhomme. These were French guys who grew up in this amazing gastronomic tradition. There wasn't Spain or Scandinavia or everything else back then. France was the glowing epicenter where we all strive to work. John Doherty, an Irish-American from Long Island who became chef of the Waldorf Astoria in the 1980s, gave the book to his cooks and says it gives him goosebumps to talk about it. In the internet age, it may be difficult to imagine a book having such widespread impact, but those were the times. It's like rocker Brian Eno's line about the first Velvet Underground album, released in 1968. It sold a mere 30,000 copies, but everybody who bought one started a band. A prelude to Great Chefs of France had been Bocuse's American star turn on the cover of Newsweek magazine in August 1975, a moment recalled by many future chefs who were in their teens at the time. The article, titled Food, the New Wave, didn't merely profile Bocuse, but encapsulated the entire Nouvelle Cuisine movement, including an appealing evolution from the anonymous kitchen-bound chefs of the past, reporting that Bocuse and his friends habitually stroll from the kitchen to chat with the clientele. The article went on to summarize Nouvelle Cuisine's ripples in the United States and how a new strain of gastronomic connoisseurship was taking hold. Supermarkets had begun stocking fresh herbs and organic produce. Specialty shops were doing a brisk business in cheeses, pâtés, and escargots, and kitchen supply shops were selling out of such exotic equipment as woks, which the authors took to the time to define as a Chinese cooking pan, all in spite of an economic recession. Seeing a chef in the space usually reserved for national and world leaders, entertainment phenoms, and athletes sparked the imagination of young Americans who enjoyed cooking, but would never have considered it a viable or desirable career. More and more of them began to consider chefdom as a profession. But with no homegrown toques to mentor them, they quickly realized that a necessary rite of passage was to get next to a French or European chef and soak up as much knowledge as possible. You had to learn from them. They had the keys, says Mike Colomico, a working-class Philly native, amateur boxer, and gym rat who cooked around New York City in the 1980s. They knew. Making consommé, the first time you actually made that clarification, or the first time the chef took you in and showed you how to make a pâté or pike quenelle, it was like you were being handed something special, a knowledge skill set that not a lot of people had, and the only way in there was through them. It's like prison. To many of these young Americans, culinary schools beckoned, offering a crash course in the fundamentals of cooking and proximity to French, or at least European, masters. That same Newsweek article touted an increase in enrollment at these schools, helping plant a seed that would lead to further matriculations. Many readers had never heard of such a thing as a chef college until then. Traditionally, culinary academics had been trade or technical schools, a notch up from where you might become an auto mechanic or hairstylist. The most well-known U.S. cooking school was, and remains, the Culinary Institute of America, though it was hardly the only one of note. With dreams that went beyond merely learning a marketable, menial skill, a new, more ambitious breed of young Americans began mixing in with the traditional student population at the Culinary Institute of America throughout the 1970s. With a steadily escalating concentration of aspirants toward the end of the decade and into the 1980s. Some were, by traditional standards, a bit old for school, but were swept up in the food craze. Doherty, who trained there from 1976 through 1978, recalls that one or two guys were career change people in their 30s or 40s. They were old dudes. They had struggled in their career. Now they're chasing their dream, going after what they really want to do, because they can. But most of the people were coming out of high school with very little experience. The evolution of the Culinary Institute of America, commonly referred to as the CIA or the Culinary by students and graduates, helpfully traces the evolution of the profession and of the ever-changing landscape of restaurant food in the United States. The school was founded in New Haven, Connecticut in 1946 as a trade school for World War II veterans. The driving force behind its creation was Frances Roth, known to Connecticut society as a strong-willed woman with a talent for achieving ambitious goals. She was the first female member of the Connecticut Bar Association and central to efforts to tamp down vice in New Haven. And so, when a group of restaurant owners sought to improve their establishment's food, they turned to her with the idea of developing a better class of cook culled from the ranks of returning GIs. Roth found a passionate backer in Catherine Angel, wife of Yale University President James Roland Angel, whose oldest son was killed in the waning days of World War II, and who subsequently poured herself into veterans' causes. In May 1946, the school kicked off as the New Haven Restaurant Institute, with 50 students and a modest faculty comprising a chef, a baker, and a dietitian. The 6-week or 10-week curriculum, sources differ on the length, pumped out worker bees proficient in making American staples such as beef stew and apple pie. By 1950, the Institute had gone through a name change, becoming the Restaurant Institute of Connecticut, and according to the school, graduated 600 veterans hailing from 38 states. A year later, it took on a name reflective of its burgeoning national stature, the Culinary Institute of America. The resulting monogram, CIA, drew curious stares when it began appearing on student sweatshirts around New Haven, implying a class of aspiring spooks, rather than the annual influx of cooks, had infiltrated the college town. Throughout the 1950s and 60s, the school's reputation grew. The New York Times' Craig Claiborne held a special fascination for it, and for Frances Roth. In a 1958 article lamenting the state of classic French cuisine in the United States, Claiborne swooned. "There is one person making a valiant effort to perpetuate classic cookery in this country. She is Mrs. Frances Roth, a handsome grandmother and lawyer, who until 12 years ago had never seen the inside of the kitchen of a public dining room." By 1960, the CIA's curriculum had evolved into two courses of study. The first was an extension of the original program, conferring instruction in making the jingoistic grub prepared, carved, and ogled by Norman Rockwell subjects, roasts, gravies, pies, the 80 dishes most requested by American diners at the time. The advanced course was open to the top half of each graduating class and was devoted to the canon of French cookery, everything from cream and wine sauces to baking and desserts. Instruction in special disciplines such as ice carving and pulling sugar were available to those with the aptitude. By this time, some foreign students had begun to matriculate, as had a few women, a very few, just 2 in a class of 200 that year. Despite the incorporation of an auxiliary campus to accommodate overflow, as 1970 approached, the school was straining beyond its capacity. After a search for new homes that stretched as far west as Chicago and as far south as Atlanta, the school landed relatively close by, at the St. Andrew-on-Hudson Jesuit Novitiate, a 75-acre enclave in Hyde Park, New York. Within a decade, it had begun to morph into today's state-of-the-art facility, boasting 11 production kitchens, a research kitchen, 2 pantries, 4 bake shops, 3 student dining rooms, a wine tasting room, a meat-cutting department, and a 14,000-volume library. And it was thriving, welcoming approximately 1,400 students into a 2-year course, into which had been folded such disciplines as advanced pastry, banquet planning, ice carving, and business law. The average student age was 20, and the school remained predominantly male, with a ratio of 6 men to each woman. The CIA experienced some turbulence in the late 1970s, burning through 2 presidents in as many years. To the rescue came Ferdinand Metz, installed as president in 1980. A native of Munich who had apprenticed at Café Feldernal and been chef at the Deutscher Kaiser Hotel, Metz immigrated to the United States in 1965. He worked for Henry Sewell at Le Pavillon and as banquet chef at the Plaza Hotel, and had most recently been developing new products for H.J. Heinz. Tension between his immediate predecessor, J. Joseph Meng, and the school's 25-member board of trustees had reportedly sunk Meng. Since Metz was a member of that board, many believed he would be able to navigate the politics of the job. It was also an exciting time for the school, since Metz was beginning to take the institute in new directions, attracting high-profile instructors and rounding out the curriculum, recalled Alfred Portali, who graduated the CIA in 1981. The CIA mostly trained Americans, but reflecting Europe's culinary supremacy, most of the school's instructors were Swiss, German, or French. The school required that prospective students have some professional experience, but memories of people who were there vary about what the minimum was. Most remember that it was 1 or 2 years. Current CIA President Tim Ryan, himself a graduate of the school, believes there was no prerequisite, but ironically, he is in the minority. For the most part, though, the experience was limited to casual restaurants in the students' hometowns. When they got to the CIA, many were exposed for the first time to the phenomenon of chef as drill sergeant, the prototypical, absurdly demanding, occasionally red-faced, borderline abusive European taskmaster. Some became legendary among the legion of cooks who attended the CIA, such as Fritz Sonnenschmidt and Roland Henin. Henin was this tall French guy with these big hands and really long nose, remembers Colomico, and he would fuck with you. He'd turn your oven off and not tell you, to teach you that you should check your oven every 15 minutes. Because you know what happens in commercial kitchens? That kind of shit happens. Maybe the pilot fucking blew out. Maybe the thermostat's wrong. Maybe some guy just doesn't like you. It's like prison. John Kowalski, who graduated the CIA in 1977 and is now an instructor there, believes that many instructors just wanted to see if newbies could hack it. He also fondly recalls that each of his instructors had at least one off-hours diversion that would allow him to decompress, and that revealed another, softer side of his personality. Out in the country, or returning from a weekend with exquisite, fresh, uncultivated oysters from Rhode Island, they were like little babies, he says. The instructors were also the embodiment of the students' ambitions. As they observed European maestros butchering whole animals, pulling sugar, demonstrating more potato preparations than any American knew existed, whipping up every conceivable sauce from memory, and displaying an exquisite touch with puff pastry, they got their first taste of the Everest before them, and an insatiable desire to summit it. And one of the first realities for culinary school graduates to digest was the gap between cooking school and real pro kitchens. And so French kitchens, and more generally European kitchens, whether in New York City or abroad, became the unofficial finishing schools for cooks, the places where blanks were filled in, skills were honed, real-world chops were earned, and acceptance was conferred. The way I looked at school was that when I graduated, that wasn't the end of my education. It was the beginning, says Larry Forgione, one of the first of the prototypical modern-day chefs to matriculate at the CIA. When I left, I was probably the only person I know that was taking jobs for experience and not for position or money. Forgione's approach, prizing knowledge over mere employment, was ahead of its time when he graduated in 1974, but by the early 1980s was becoming the norm for a portion of each graduating class. Cooking schools are fine, says Colomico, who graduated in 1982. But I'm not sure cooking was ever meant to be taught that way. It hadn't been historically. You do an apprenticeship. That's how it is in France, and that's how it is in most of the world. You start at 13 or 14, and you just learn how to do the craft from someone that's good at it. What you can't get in school, says Colomico, is the reality of a working kitchen. A restaurant is not a laboratory. It's not conceptual. Indeed, There was an entire class of Americans who followed the European model, never attending a culinary institute. The most notable example being the most celebrated chef of that generation, Thomas Keller. Another chef who forewent culinary school was Stephen Lyle, an American who trained in France in the late 1970s, and cooked for fellow American Leslie Revson at Restaurant Leslie, a well-respected Nouvelle Cuisine outpost on Cornelia Street in Greenwich Village. "I'd worked with some CIA grads," remembers Lyle, "and they were great with jargon, and they'd talk about their me's a lot. But they just didn't really know what the hell they were doing. Not so unusual for a kid straight out of school, but they thought they knew everything." We would kind of laugh about that. "People I worked with, a lot of them had been trained in France. We just knew a hell of a lot more than these kids did." Lyle describes a rivalry between those who came up in pro kitchens and the cooking school grads, whom he and his colleagues saw both as pretentious and as rubes. "There's obviously some very talented people, but there were also a bunch of idiots." A contrast between the East and West Coasts was how few cooks in the Golden State even contemplated culinary school. Tracy Desjardins, a spitfire who had become a protege of German-born Joachim Splitschel in his L.A. restaurant Patina, explains that Joachim wasn't oriented towards them. He was looking for hardcore French experience. Fellow Californian Jonathan Waxman expresses a more zen version of this attitude. "When people say they go to school to learn how to cook, I always laugh. Where you go to school is in the street. Where you go to school is going to other people's restaurants, or going and working at other people's restaurants, or going to people's homes, or going to the supermarkets. Cooking is so much about just living, you know?" For another sign of California's distinct sensibility, consider that one of the head instructors at San Francisco's California Culinary Academy in the early 1980s was Jeremiah Tower, who had been chef at Chez Panisse, but had no formal training. The kitchen will always embrace you. Whether or not they attended culinary school, many who set their sights on the professional kitchen during these years had more in common than a desire to learn how to cook. They were almost metabolically incompatible with traditional classroom education, which is not to say that they were not intelligent. As Bruce Springsteen once said, "One problem with the way the educational system is set up is that it only recognizes a certain type of intelligence, and it's incredibly restrictive. There's so many types of intelligence, and people who would be at their best outside of that structure get lost." Frances Roth felt the same way as the boss. She was said to be upset at the American attitude toward those who work with their hands rather than in white collars. Very often, cooks are among those lost boys and girls, and this was especially true before the alphabet soup of syndromes and disorders, ADD, ADHD, OCD, applied to today's children, was available to the mainstream. A number of influential chefs hail from the halls of academia, especially those who began cooking in Berkeley in the 1970s and 80s. But for every higher-educated chef and cook, there were, and to some extent still are, scores of cooks who didn't do well in school, who zoned out or fell asleep during class. "If I was a kid nowadays, I most likely would have been diagnosed with ADD, says Tom Colicchio. "I had all the classic signs of it. I had report cards saying, Tom should be doing X and Y, and he's doing Z. Seems always distracted." Colicchio's distractions extended even to his first kitchen forays at home. "I remember serving this particular recipe, and it was clear that I didn't read the whole thing, because when it was served, the family was like, where's the rest of the meal? It was clearly only an appetizer, and that's all I made. So my mother had to get up and bail me out." "I was not a great student," says New York City chef Scott Bryan. "I didn't really apply myself. I was bad at math, not great at English. But social studies, remembering stats, things like that, very good at them. It's ADHD. People who can't concentrate or focus. A lot of cooks I know, they're bored at school. They can't pay attention. They pay attention maybe for a minute or something. unless something catches them. Then they become idiot savants in a way. People joked about me as like Rain Man. I do the same things over and over, say the same quotes and verses. It's OCD and ADHD, in a way. I know a lot of chefs who are dyslexic, says author, producer, and television personality Anthony Bourdain. A lot of chefs who tell me, because I heard this from people who read my book, Kitchen Confidential, that they hadn't read another book since high school. I think for a lot of people who were uncomfortable in their verbal comprehension skills, reading comprehension, who felt awkward speaking or who struggled with language, here's a business that's nonverbal, that's sensual, where you can express yourself without using language. Reading skills not needed, really. You could get around it. None of which is to imply that these are unintelligent people. I would say that there are 1,000 ways for smarts to represent themselves, says Mario Batali, some of which is in developing management skills, and some of it is developing your own interpersonal ability to somehow participate and help run something good. And it's in a very physical way, whether you're building a house and you're suddenly a journeyman, adding bricklaying. Someone who starts as an introductory knucklehead on a construction job. There is a way for that person to eventually become a general contractor much faster than people who have been there a lot longer than them. And it's because they possess a faculty for understanding the larger picture while they're doing the same hand movements. It's the same way with cooks. You look at cooks and maybe these cooks hadn't made it in the military or hadn't made it in a place where somehow they hadn't accepted whatever authority was going to lead them. In the world of cooking, you can work outside of the authority in your own mind while watching everything being done. And that allows you, if you're a quick learner and attentive and watching, to learn a lot of the tricks from the very best people in the field, or in your restaurant, or within 10 feet of you, because you are able to mimic their actual hand motions. A majority of these cooks discovered the kitchen almost by accident, taking a high school job as a dishwasher. They came for spending money, then fell in love with the atmosphere, the characters, the physicality, structure, and craft. The dishwasher position, of course, is an entry-level position into the restaurant, because you don't enter as a skilled cook, even as a journeyman cook, says Christopher Lee, one-time co-chef of Chez Panisse. You start at the bottom, which is a dishwasher. That's the way into the kitchen, and that's the first station you hit when you come in the back door. You've got your toe in, and then the guy says, "Hey, can you help me with these onions?" And it sort of accrues from there. It builds from there. What's more, those who found their way to the kitchen were often treated as, or considered themselves, misfits or outcasts in normal society. I also think there are a lot of people who just sensed in themselves a general discomfort with polite society, says Bourdain. I mean, working in an office, interacting with others in a larger situation, interacting with a room full of equals. Awkward. Difficult. You don't see the high school quarterback in a kitchen that much. People who feel adrift, at odds, shy people. Some of the biggest shouters are actually very shy, insecure, tenuous people outside of the kitchen. The kitchen will always embrace you, says Batali, whose first job was as a dishwasher. If you're there to do, and do, a good job, the cooks will eventually throw you a fucking steak every now and then, because they appreciate you doing the good job, and you save them. It wasn't long before Batali moved on to the kitchen line. The cohesiveness of the team was something that I grew to like. It was something I had never seen before. People that you loved and people that you didn't even like had to come together as a team and work through the dinner service that you would eventually conquer. And it was about concentration. It was about precision. It was about mastering your hand movements and thinking around the room while you were trying to make sure that everything was going to come up in the right way. There was never anything that took longer than 11 minutes to cook, so there wasn't a lot of complexity to it. But there was certainly the high point of the adrenaline buzz of when it's working and you're working together in a team and everyone's doing their job. It's very much like a ballet or like a football team playing an excellent play. Boston chef Jasper White recalls his first impressions of the kitchen. My mother had moved to Arkansas, and I was nervous because I heard she was going to get married. And I actually packed up and went there for a little bit. and I got a job cooking breakfast in a hotel. And that was my first real cooking job. I only stayed for 6 weeks, but within 3 days I met the first openly gay women I'd ever met in my life. I worked with a German chef who had a Peruvian crew. My mentor was a guy named Uncle Charlie, who was a black man who grew up in Louisiana. Within a week, I said, "I'm home." I could be who I was. I didn't have to pretend. It wasn't a job where I had to dress up. I just threw on my uniform and went to work. I loved the contrast of the humans I was working with, the different personalities. I felt there was compassion at a level I wouldn't find anywhere else. At that particular hotel, there was a dishwasher named Robert. I don't know what was wrong with him, but he would try to drown himself in the sink when he ran out of work to do. He was handicapped. Uncle Charlie said to me, "Make sure Robert always has stuff, even if you have to give him clean stuff to wash again." And that was part of the daily routine. But it wasn't like, "We've got to get rid of this guy." It was, "We got to take care of this guy." "You know," says White, "behind the screaming and yelling and all the tough stuff that chefs can do, there was a lot of compassion." This was nothing short of a meticulously timed foreign invasion. Like the founding of the CIA, the establishment of a community of French chefs in New York City was a footnote to World War II. The unintentional catalyst was the French Pavilion at the 1939 World's Fair in the borough of Queens, New York. To Hancho France's restaurant there, the French government tapped Henri Soule, who had worked his way up from busboy at age 14 to assistant maitre d' at Café de Paris. A front-of-house man, never a chef, Soule assembled a team that included Pierre Frainy as assistant fish cook. As they bobbed across the Atlantic on the SS Normandy, key kitchen personnel met daily to plan how they'd feed the 1,000 visitors expected to dine every day at the French Pavilion. "This was nothing short of a meticulously timed foreign invasion," Frainy would later write of the enterprise. "All of the equipment, from ovens to pots and pans, was brought from France. That meant we had to construct a kitchen from the ground up." Upon arrival, the Frenchmen devoured New York City, at a time when the metropolis swayed to the big bands of Benny Goodman and Glenn Miller, fraternizing at the Vittel Club, an organization for French in the hospitality industry, sunning themselves at Jones Beach, and visiting the cinemas and nightclubs of Times Square. They were to return home after 2 spring-summer runs in America, but with the occupation of France by the Nazis, most elected to stay put. By 1941, their leader, Soule, had opened his own restaurant at 5 East 55th Street in Midtown Manhattan, naming it Le Pavillon, and many of his fellow refugees flowed into his employ. The French Pavilion was intended as the ultimate showcase for haute cuisine, and with that DNA, Le Pavillon quickly rose to the ranks of the finest restaurants in America. Ferdinand Metz, the future president of the Culinary Institute of America, worked there as fish and vegetable cook in the mid-1960s, and commented, "I think it gave people the understanding of what cooking and service at its very best could be." Le Pavillon became a fixture in New York City, and Soule became one of its most well-known dining room impresarios, welcoming Manhattan's aristocracy, its Kennedys and Rockefellers, though he wasn't considered gracious by all guests. He regularly offended Columbia Pictures mogul Harry Cohn, also his landlord, by seating him in the back, prompting Cohn to more than double his rent, from $18,000 to $40,000. Rather than pay it, Soule moved Le Pavillon to the Ritz Tower 57th Street, eventually returning and reopening on 55th Street as Le Côte Basque, a less expensive restaurant. Le Pavillon became a sort of university for French front-of-house men and cooks in New York City. "Le Pavillon was my alma mater, my Princeton, my Yale," said assistant head waiter Fred Decker, who left in 1960 to launch Le Caravelle. Another who worked there before becoming a restaurateur in his own right was maitre d' Charles Masson, who would go on to launch Le Grenou at 3 East 52nd Street in 1962. Throughout the 1960s, a constellation of additional French restaurants proliferated in Midtown Manhattan, such as Lutèce on East 50th Street in 1961, where André Soltner rose to 4-star prominence, and Lessine on East 54th Street in 1969, where Lane Sailhack did the same. I really believed that the dining experience could be something special, and certainly at that time it wasn't. One of the defining threads of the evolution of the American chef in the late 1970s and early 80s in New York City is the story of these three worlds: aspiring Americans, the CIA, and the French-European Old Guard, colliding, becoming acclimated to one another, and eventually unifying. First, the colliding. Although many young cooks revered the French, some were rubbed the wrong way by them, regarding them as more haughty than haute. The Quilted Giraffe's Barry Wine cherished his dining experience in France. One even brought a tear to his eye, but loathed French restaurants in Manhattan, most especially their snootiness, and delighted that his business was right around the corner from the most fabled French restaurant in town, L'Hôtesse. The Quilted Giraffe had printed on the menu from day one the quote from Brillat Savarin, "There is no place like the table for reconciling body and spirit to the anguish of a life that is necessarily too short and too imperfect," remembers Wine. I really believed that the dining experience could be something special, and certainly at that time it wasn't. In the French restaurants, it was stilted and it was looking down on Americans. And so the goal of the Quilted Giraffe was to show that Americans could run a 4-star restaurant. Wine's attitude animated his menu. "You couldn't cook American food unless you knew who Howdy Doody was," says Wine. In 1985, you could say that because anybody of cooking age had seen Howdy Doody. But if you grew up in France, you didn't understand the Howdy Doody experience. It had to do with looking at things in an American way. This was the beginning of serving chili for $75, fried chicken for $75. It wasn't just the American accent in the food. Wine also eschewed the French tendency toward authoritarianism and abuse as the default style of kitchen leadership. Remembers Tom Colicchio, "It wasn't about just being a brute and yelling and screaming and carrying on, doing everything by force. This was all about finesse. It was more cerebral." Colicchio explains how Wine's collaborative approach led to distinctly American compositions. One day Barry said, "I want to do a dish, but I want it to be American. What's really American?" We were throwing some ideas around. I said, "How about a clam bake?" He went, "Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Now, how do we get that on a dish?" He didn't mean a clam bake that goes on the dish. How do we turn that idea into a dish? I think we worked it into a lobster ravioli with corn, something like a butter sauce with corn and tarragon. That's the kind of thing that he would think of. Even when the Quilted Giraffe received 4 stars from the New York Times, Wine got no recognition or encouragement from the top French chefs in town, such as L'Hôtesse's Soltner or Sailhack, who moved from Lessine to Le Cirque in 1978. "They did not come to look," says Wine. "Some of the French from France actually came to look. Some guys from Lyon. Ultimately, Paul Bocuse. They all came." Wine says that even earning high marks from Gaulle and Millau didn't break the ice. "When you went to the awards luncheon, still the French chefs wouldn't give you respect. They'd stand together and speak French." But he insists that the cold shoulder didn't sting him in the least. In fact, it made for competition. "It was motivating," he says. Even those who worked for Wine felt the French chill toward the Quilted Giraffe. Kinch, who overlapped with Colicchio there, received barbs from not only French cooks, but also Americans who worked in French kitchens, who would chide Kinch and his Quilted Giraffe colleagues if they ended up in the same bar after hours, mocking the restaurant's 4-star status. "Read 'em and weep," Kinch would retort, holding 4 fingers up over his beer. Tom Carlin says that although he might have sensed the French guard's indifference toward Wine, it didn't bother him. "We probably felt that they were old school. The classic French had already peaked and was going down. For us, they were passé, so I don't think it bothered us that we thought they didn't respect us. I don't know if we respected them." Colicchio believes that Wine's great appeal to diners of the day, his outside-the-box thinking, was the very thing that turned off the French. "I think that's why a lot of the chefs didn't like it. Sometimes that experiment would backfire, like asparagus ice cream and sweetbreads. But Barry was always thinking. He was always looking. He was the first person I know that took a trip to Japan, came back from Tokyo, and said, "We're going to start moving in that direction.